Meetings is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Scholin presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, or afternoon. We were morning. Give me a moment. I have a lot of stuff. I'm really happy we're not on bonk anymore, so we have more room on the bench. My name is Judge Scholin. To my right is Judge Greenberg. To my left is Judge Allen. We're here today in the case of Conley F. Monk versus Robert L. Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 15-1280. Would counsel each please note your appearance for the record?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Lynn Nooner of Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, together with the Yale Law School Veterans Clinic, representing the petitioner.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Brent Boker and Christopher Wallace for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Your Honor.
Thank you. Does petitioner's counsel wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
We would, Your Honor. We request 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to note today, I understand we have Mr. Monk with a family member and Mr. Dolphin present. Thank you. We're always happy when veterans get to come and see their cases today. And we also have a couple special guests of Judge Allen's son, Ben, and his friend are here in attendance. So let's all please put on a good show for them. Okay, you may proceed when ready, Ms. Ford.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Before I begin, I would like to recognize that Mr. Monk and Mr. Dolphin have both traveled to be here with us today. Mr. Monk and Mr. Dolphin, would you please indicate your presence to the court?
Thank you, sir.
The crux of this case is the proper standard to adjudicate the petitioner's statutory and constitutional rights to be free from the Secretary's egregious multi-year delays in the VA appeals process. There are three things that the proper standard must take into account. First, Congress's express intent to create a pro-veteran scheme and Congress's decision to empower this court to compel agency action unreasonably delayed. Second, the Federal Circuit's decision in Martin, which rejected Costanza because it had created too high a barrier for veterans seeking relief. And third, that there must be some point beyond which delay becomes conclusively or presumptively unreasonable.
Could I ask a question before you get into those arguments? So there is an appeal, as I understand, of the court's 4-4 tie, if you will, denying class certification.
Correct, Your Honor.
As I understand the status of that appeal, I believe the government's brief is due tomorrow, actually. Do you happen to know?
The government has already filed their reply.
Oh, they have. And the government is not, as you understand it, contesting jurisdiction in the Federal Circuit?
They have not yet.
Right. So what do we do about our jurisdiction? In other words, this is an entirely brand new situation because we've never had an order that denied class certification like that before.
Yes.
That somebody then appealed.
Yes.
That wasn't its own separate judgment.
Yes.
Do we have the power to proceed now that the Federal Circuit has taken jurisdiction over whatever it is they're going to treat the class motion as?
Yes, Your Honor, there has not been a stay, and particularly in a case with respect to delay, it's critical for this court to move forward, as this court saw fit, to rule on the merits of the underlying petition for writs of mandamus here.
Well, I agree that it would be, you know, somewhat ironic in a delay case to delay.
Yes, Your Honor.
But by the same token, we have this independent obligation to ensure that we have power to act. And normally, as I understand general civil practice, when a notice of appeal is filed, say from a district court to a regional circuit, that largely divests the lower tribunal from power to act, at least generically.
Your Honor, this court found that it would follow Rule 23 as guidance. There is no rule prohibiting this court from moving forward in this situation. And as you noted, particularly where the issue is delay, it is critical for this court to move forward. And your power under the All Writs Act does provide you the power to provide relief for either the statutory and the constitutional harms that these petitioners are facing.
And so just the last point, well, we did adopt Rule 23 as a guide, but of course, we couldn't do anything with 23F, right? Because we couldn't do something that would empower the Federal Circuit to have jurisdiction if they didn't, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. You could craft the rules going forward. The rulemaking committee could craft the rules as they saw fit. But it is critical for this court to reach the merits here. And we have petitioners who have been waiting multiple years. Mr. Dolphin, who is here today, has waited over 4 years for a decision on his claim, which at this point is just an effective date, which they could have resolved at any point during those 4 years. And it's critical for this court to be able to provide relief to Mr. Dolphin, who has waited that long on such a simple claim. I'd like to return to my first point, Your Honor, which is with respect to congressional intent here. In addition to 38 U.S.C. 7261, the Supreme Court recognized in Brown versus Gardner that there is an interpretive rule that any doubt is to be resolved in favor of the veteran. So if there's any question here about how to interpret what unreasonable delay means in this context, it should be interpreted uniquely here to be in favor of the veteran in a way that is not necessarily present in other cases. And this is in line with Congress's longstanding solicitude for veterans, as, again, the Supreme Court recognized in U.S. versus Oregon, that these are veterans here. They have served our country, and they deserve to have their benefits adjudicated in a timely manner.
I'd like to interject and talk a little bit about the Secretary's arguments of mootness.
Yes, Your Honor.
You argue that the voluntary cessation exception to mootness applies because the challenged action here is too short in duration to be fully litigated. I don't understand how that jives with your arguments about extensive and unreasonable delay.
Your Honor, that goes to the capable of repetition yet evading review.
But it has to be both steps. It can't.
For that, in addition, the voluntary cessation, the standard from Friends of the Earth versus Laidlaw, and I quote, establishes a heavy burden on the defendant to show that it is absolutely clear the allegedly wrongful behavior could not reasonably be expected to recur. And so in Ms. Obey's case, applying that standard here, her case actually provides great evidence of the fact that there is a reasonable expectation that these types of delays are to recur. So she is now on an April 2018 NOD, experiencing 11 months of delay since that, and that indicates that even though her 2015 NOD was resolved, that she is once again experiencing delays. And so those petitioners, the three petitioners, Mr. Monk, Mr. Hudson, and Ms. Obey, should not be considered moot. Importantly, however, the Secretary has conceded that Mr. Dolphin has a live claim. And so
I think with mootness, we're only discussing the other ones.
Yes, Your Honor.
But didn't Martin say that a separate element, such as effective date that we're talking about in, for example, Ms. Obey's case, would be not subject to the same petition, so it would be moot? How do we work around that here?
Your Honor, we're not arguing that her 2018 NOD should be part of the original amended petition. We are arguing that those three, the delay for Ms. Obey in particular from her 2015 NOD, the 3 years of delay that she experienced before the VA provided a decision on her claim there, that should fall under the exception to mootness because the Secretary has not been able to show that that type of delay won't reasonably be expected to recur. And as I said, her April 2018 NOD, the delay continuing from there, is great evidence of the fact that these types of delays continue again and again. And this is something that the...
Can I just ask before you leave, Ms. Obey, this is a very detailed question, is the April 23rd, 2018 NOD, that's the one you're pointing to as your trigger here?
The trigger here is the July 2015 NOD that Ms. Obey filed, and that was with respect to the benefits that are owed to Brittany, her daughter.
Right, but the daughter has now been granted benefits.
That's correct. There is a decision that has been provided, and so her claims, as with Mr. Hudson's, as with Mr. Monk's, should fall under the exception to mootness here.
But she doesn't have, you're not suggesting that she has an outstanding NOD?
Not one that is at issue in the amended petition. She does have a live appeal, but that is separate and not part of the amended petition. Moving to the important...
Wait. I'm sorry. I'm still trying to follow. So if she's received what she sought...
She did not receive entirely what she sought, and that's what her 2018 April NOD is about.
Right, but you said that's not part of the amended petition.
That is not part of the writ of mandamus that we're asking for. Our writ of mandamus was filed in January 2018.
So what kind of remedy would you be seeking as to Ms. Obi?
Yeah, well, and precisely, assume that my colleague Judge Sholin is going to actually have to write something down.
Yes.
What would you write? I mean, what would we order the secretary to do?
In addition to Mr. Dolphin's claim, where you would compel action and a decision,
Mr. Dolphin, I understand, right. But for all of the other people for whom, and I understand your argument,
yes,
I understand it conceptually, but what would we order the secretary to do?
Your Honor, your order would acknowledge, would hold that the delay that they experienced was a violation of TRAC, was unreasonable delay, and was a violation of their constitutional due process rights.
Could we do that? I mean, that's not ordering the secretary to do anything. That's making what I would think that the justices way back in 1789 would have said was an advisory opinion, right?
Your Honor, in Re United States, the Ninth Circuit dealt with a similar problem, and I think it's useful here. So there, the court was dealing with pro hoc vice motions, and what's important to recognize is even though the court below had actually granted the pro hoc vice motions, they recognized it was important, even though it would be, and I quote, an empty gesture, it would be superfluous to still provide a decision. They found it was critical because the party there needed assurances that going forward, that type of issue would not recur.
Well, but of course, that was Judge Jones, the District of Nevada cases, where he was not allowing, he had indicated that he wasn't going to allow Department of Justice lawyers to appear, and had made it pretty clear, I'm always going to say you can't appear, right? And that's sort of different than this, isn't it?
No, because in this case, the secretary, we are seeing a pattern of repeated delays here. As the Federal Circuit recognized in Martin, for example, we see delays on average in the certification stage, which is a purely ministerial stage, of 773 days.
But wouldn't that be, in the case of the three, not Mr. Dolphin, a declaratory judgment or an advisory opinion, as he's saying? Because we're not actually providing any relief to them because they've received relief. And if you're talking about future harm, that would be a different complaint.
Your Honor, our position is that this court could issue a holding and it would not be an advisory opinion, and it would be in the style of the In Re United States holding, which recognized, even though the relief had been granted, this type of recurring behavior warranted them to set out precedent, and this court, as a panel, can establish that precedent and hold.
This court is prohibited from issuing declaratory judgments. That's, we're not part of the Declaratory Judgment Act, Nagler. I'm having difficulty seeing a way around that when we're not actually providing relief to these veterans.
Hold it, if I may. Some of us don't agree with everything that's just been said.
But I'm asking her a question. I'm asking you. Just teasing.
Go ahead. Answer her question, and then I'll.
I'll ask
a question.
Your Honor, in this case, it's critical to ensure that the secretary is not able to continue to evade accountability from this court, and I see you nodding, Judge Greenberg, that they have systemic inefficiencies that are causing these delays, and these delays are faced by the petitioners and other veterans over and over and over again.
And they've been told over and over again to get with the program, haven't they, by the Federal Circuit?
That is
by
correct.
Some of us on this court.
That is correct.
And they continue to ignore it, don't they? Isn't that really your argument?
That is
correct. Why do we have to, is this a question of standing?
No, Your Honor, this is a question of...
We have real people here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who, if we issued an order compelling the secretary, as a matter of law, to correct this systemic fault in their procedures...
Yes.
presumably they'd follow it.
Yes, Your Honor.
But we know that they don't always do that.
That's correct. And
the Staub case comes to mind, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's critical to recognize that Mr. Dolphin, this court could rule today, it could issue a ruling that his delay of more than 4 years that he's been waiting for a decision on his effective date is unreasonable under track and a constitutional violation, opinion to follow. That is something that this court could do today. And returning to the Martin language, which I think is very important, the holding of Martin is that Costanza had set too high a barrier for veterans seeking relief. It cannot be that this court remains powerless to actually hold the secretary accountable for these recurring and extensive delays.
If I may, actually, wasn't Martin and adopting these track, whatever it's called, telecom research, wasn't that supposed to be a pro-veteran decision?
Absolutely, Your
Honor. So what are we waiting around for?
Absolutely.
At this court?
A change needs to happen. It cannot be that, as the Secretary is effectively asking this court, that this court is simply reinstating the Costanza standard. Here,
I'd like to turn to track.
Yes.
In the first test, the first
factor,
item, whatever, criteria.
Yes, Your Honor.
Talks about the rule of reason.
Correct.
And I believe in your pleadings that you filed, your supplemental brief, you talk about that we should look at the reasonableness of the length of the delay, not the reasons the agency provides. And I'm not sure I'm clear on what exactly you're advising.
And so if you look at D.C. Circuit cases, and particularly, for example, MCI telecommunications versus FCC, which is actually the case that the track court drew the rule of reason from, there they focus on the rule of reason for them was how long is the delay in light of certain factors. And there they did not hesitate to say there must be some limit to the FCC's, the time it takes for the FCC to adjudicate that rate-making decision. Similarly, in PCHRG versus Octor, they found 3 years simply too long. And that's a quote from that case.
Yeah, you said in light of certain factors. What kind of factors did they consider?
They looked to the type of analysis and process that went into the rate making. So, for example, there, they acknowledged that the rate making was enormously complex, and that's language from the case. And yet they still found that they could hold that agency accountable to a certain timeline, and that 4 years in that case was simply too long.
Now, we're talking about Mr. Dolphin.
Correct.
4 years. Now, during that 4 years, it's my understanding that VA gave him some exams. I think they conducted a DRO hearing. They wrote a 69-page statement of the case.
That is correct.
And at which point they had resolved several of his issues favorably. And then after the SOC, they still did additional development or decision-making such that they granted him recently TDIU?
Yes, that is correct.
So it's not 4 years of inactivity, as you've termed it. It's fits and spurts, right? And I understand the under Martin and other cases, it says ministerial actions, delay is bad, non-ministerial, we might understand it. What actions in this chain of events would you assert are ministerial and which would you say are not?
One great example of a ministerial step is the certification, which in Mr. Dolphin's case took nearly 1 year. It was 11 months. And that is something that the Federal Circuit itself acknowledged that the VA has not provided any justification or explanation for delay in that ministerial.
Now, it's my understanding that subsequent to the certification, he was awarded TDIU. Is that correct?
I believe it was before, but yes.
Okay. So please keep going.
What's critical about Mr. Dolphin's claim is that throughout the 4 years, what remains pending is an effective date challenge. And so that's a purely legal, very simple claim that doesn't require any of these medical examinations or the submission of new evidence. And
well, that it could.
It could, but what it comes down to is when, in November 2009, whether or not that was a claim for benefits that he had filed and that the VA acknowledged.
Well, but he might have also had to establish that he was actually ill at that time and at the rating that they seek. So there are medical determinations that may or may not have needed to be made, or effective date. There are other ways to get an earlier effective date, such as 3.156B, et cetera. So,
yes, Your Honor, I submit to you that 4 years, however, is patently too long even to do those types of steps. And Mr. Dolphin has had to undergo financial pressure and the strain, the mental strain that is placed on him after he is suffering from severe injuries and chronic pain due to his service. That is not the pro-veteran scheme that Congress intended to enact. And as the Federal Circuit recognized in Martin, many petitioners die while they wait for their appeals to be adjudicated.
And that's the end.
And that's the end.
Unlike Article III situations, maybe the estate will inherit it, maybe somebody else, but here we have a limited degree of substitution available, right? I think I'm the only oldest person in the room, but these veterans have to be getting along here. Isn't that a fact that we should consider?
That is absolutely.
How long do they have to wait?
Exactly, Your Honor, and that is the key question for this court.
Shouldn't we be entering, is your argument that we should be making a determination as a matter of law that 1 year, beyond 1 year is too long?
That is correct, Your Honor, that beyond 1 year, under TRAC and the Due Process Clause, it is either conclusively or presumptively unreasonable, and that this court needs to remedy that delay for these petitioners.
If you'll excuse me a moment. Don, can you add 5 minutes, please?
That would comport with the pro-veteran scheme that Congress intended to enact. That would comport with the longstanding solicitude that Congress has for these veterans to not create a system and allow a system to continue without any accountability in which veterans are dying before they actually are able to get an adjudication and a decision on their appeal. I'd like to talk a little bit about due process as well, because
On that point, I did have a question.
Yes.
So the Federal Circuit seemed to suggest in Martin that, sort of surprisingly to me, but suggested that perhaps the constitutional issue really goes away as something a court is to address, because it says that if the court does the track analysis, that it doesn't need to. It says that the Veterans Court employing the track analysis finds the delay unreasonable or not unreasonable, it need not separately analyze the due process claim based on that same delay. So I may not agree with that, but that seems pretty clear that either way we would rule, the constitutional issue would be off the table.
Your Honor, we disagree. Actually, we believe that your footnote 57 in the en banc opinion got this correct, which is that the Federal Circuit declined to reach the due process, but it cannot be that this court is foreclosed categorically from considering the constitutional harms at issue here.
And if I would have had two more people agree with you, then they would have given me five. But as it was, it wasn't. So, I mean, is your argument maybe that this language is, well, clear is dicta?
Yes, Your Honor. And the language, moreover, the language it quotes from VVA versus Shinseki is also dicta. That was a case about standing. That case did not definitively hold that courts could not reach due process. And as I said, that would be it would be improper to find that a court simply could not reach the constitutional issues.
So then I'm assuming then you must be taking the position that analytically, because we would have to do the track factors first, right? The principles of constitutional avoidance would suggest we don't get to the due process clause.
It would counsel in favor of analyzing track first. Yes,
right. Justice Brandeis, right? So, but then that would mean that we would find that a delay is not unreasonable, but could we then still find that it is a violation of due process under the Constitution?
Yes, Your Honor, and this is because the analysis is different. So, for example, in Brown versus Plata, the Supreme Court recognized that any sort of collateral effect of a remedy for a constitutional harm cannot preclude a court from nevertheless finding that that remedy is necessary under the Constitution. That was a case about prison overcrowding. Similarly, in Matthews versus Eldridge, they recognize that financial constraints or resource constraints is not a controlling weight in that analysis. And so to the degree that the Secretary might make arguments that they are resource constrained, those arguments cannot preclude a constitutional remedy in this case. And that's why there are critical analytical differences.
Well, if we do agree with you and go on to reach the due process question, do you advocate that we apply the test in FDIC v. Mallon?
Yes, Your Honor. And our position is that under applying that test, beyond 1 year is conclusively or should be conclusively or presumptively a violation of the Fifth Amendment due process clause.
One of the factors in that test is the likelihood that the underlying decision was wrong. What kind of evidence have you presented to us to meet that burden?
A few responses to that. The first is that, as the BVA 2018 report found, 75% of decisions at the BVA receive a favorable ruling. So many of those veterans are actually—
By a favorable ruling, you include a remand?
Yeah, that is correct, Your Honor. Many of these veterans, a great share of them, are entitled to these benefits. They have a constitutional right and a property interest to receive these benefits. And there are many of them for which the interim stage is an erroneous deprivation of those benefits. And so our belief is that the three factors combined indicate, once again, there must be some point beyond which that delay becomes a constitutional violation.
Well, we wouldn't have to actually go as far as you suggested by saying 1 year. I mean, the magic 1 year was, as I understand it, in some measure, much more critical for purposes of the class argument. That was meant to be part of the class definition. Here, let's just take Mr. Dolphin. Mr. Dolphin is 4 years. And
yes, Your
so
Honor.
We could leave aside 1 year, right?
Yes, Your Honor, you could, and you could find that in Mr. Dolphin's case, the delay he has experienced goes too far. What's important to yes, Your Honor.
Don, please add 5 more minutes.
Thank you. What's important to recognize is there are benefits as well to finding a per se rule or a presumptive rule that would actually hold the VA accountable and ensure that this type of delay isn't occurring in other veterans' cases as well and doesn't recur again even for the petitioners. And yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to ask you about the 1 year.
Yes.
So when a veteran gets a decision from the regional office, they have 1 year within which to file their notice of disagreement. So how can we ask VA that they have to decide a case within a year if the veteran has a year? I know it's from the NOD,
yes.
But then let's say the veteran files it on day one after they get their decision. Then they have the remainder of that year or 60 days after they get a statement of the case. So they have another 364 days. Thus leaving VA 1 day to issue a decision if we create a per se rule within 1 year.
Your Honor, our timeline begins with the filing of the NOD, so any time they took before that would not be included.
Right, but what I'm saying is the veteran could file the NOD on day one after they get their decision. So then under the regulation, they have the remainder of the year or 60 days after they get a statement of the case to file their substantive appeal to the board. So you're asking the board to make a decision basically in 1 day.
I see. It's a great question, Your Honor. There would be some cases, some subset of cases where, for example, if the veteran themselves were requesting additional time to submit, for example, those cases, in those cases, a waiver could apply similarly to how veterans may waive their right to submit new evidence. A veteran who chose to, let's say, wait a longer period of time for 11 months, that veteran could waive his right to have the presumptive or conclusive rule at 1 year.
But what if they don't want to waive their right? They demand VA. I followed the rules that you gave me, therefore I want my decision in a day. Would that be a reasonable rule for us to impose on the agency?
Your Honor, it's possible this court could consider crafting in those types of cases, were it to come before the court, an exception if necessary in those cases. Importantly, the VA has not provided any evidence that that type of case is common. For example, you note the 60-day time period. On average, as the Federal Circuit noted, veterans only take 37 of those days to actually move forward. And so, respectfully, we believe those types of cases would be extremely rare, and it's in the veterans' benefit to move forward with these appeals. These appeals leave them in constant uncertainty and mental strain on benefits that are often critical to their well-being and their health and welfare.
Would there be a factor that we should consider on additional procedures that the veterans choose to avail themselves of? Like, for example, Mr. Dolphin asked for a DRO hearing and a BVA hearing. Should those veterans have a longer period, or should veterans who don't ask for those procedures have less than 1 year?
Your Honor, our position is that those types of procedures should be completable within the one-year timeline. Many of the things at issue here, for example, examinations, should not take months and months and months. And so our position is that it should be able to be completed within the one-year timeline. And it's important to recognize the Secretary has also, in this case, attempted to weaponize the duty to assist here. They are using it as both a sword and a shield to evade accountability from this court and evade judicial review for the systemic inefficiencies that are going on in the VA appeals process. That was not congressional intent. The duty to assist was intended to help veterans. It was not intended to be used as an excuse to enable these types of delays to continue. Additionally, Your Honors, it's important to consider that you can issue today, as we said, a decision that Mr. Dolphin's appeal has gone beyond, it has gone too far, and is now unreasonable. And today, this court could say, this is unreasonable under track, this is a constitutional violation, and could have the opinion follow. But what's critical is to recognize here that Mr. Dolphin is clearly experiencing a statutory and a constitutional.
Well, why shouldn't we do that? By analogy, ex parte querying, Supreme Court of the United States, in the case of the Nazi spies, said, take them out and shoot them. They've had their due process, and we'll tell you all our reasons a few months from now. And they did.
That is precisely.
So we could rule from the bench today, couldn't we?
Yes, you could. And that is
what. And you're asking us to do that, among other things?
Yes, among other things, in addition.
Give him his remedy, and then we'll explain all our reasoning, back and forth, in and out, up and down, later.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is what the.
Nothing wrong with that, is there?
No. That is what the petitioners would call for. And it's important to take a step back and recognize the harm that these ongoing delays have for veterans. It's easy to lose sight and think in terms of years and years, but every single day, these veterans are deprived of their benefits.
Well, let me use another analogy that may not.
Excuse me, could you add 2 more minutes, please?
That may not be quite apt, but didn't Potter Stewart in the obscenity cases say, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it?
Yes,
isn't a certain level of delay kind of arbitrary? We may not know whether it's 1 year, or in the case of Veterans for Common Sense, in my view, the correct opinion, 2-1, as opposed to 9-1, the other way, 2 years was too long, violated the Fifth Amendment right. So in the case of Mr. Dolphin, isn't it, what is it, 4 years we're talking about?
It's over 4 years now.
And so whatever it is, wherever we put the mark, this is within it, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, petitioners would recommend that this court also establish as a first-time precedential interpretation of track and of the standard under the Due Process Clause that 1 year conclusively or presumptively is unreasonable or a constitutional violation. However, this court can and should also recognize today that Mr. Dolphin is experiencing a statutory and a constitutional harm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The Secretary respectfully asks the court to the extent they are not moot, to deny the petitions here today, Your Honors. Under the first track factor, the rule of reason, it requires the court to look at the agency action being challenged. Although petitioners say the agency action being challenged is the issuance of a board decision, they've started their time frame at the notice of disagreement. So that is not one agency action that they're challenging. It's a series, it's a process beginning with the notice of disagreement, ending with the board decision. That is a series of agency actions. At a minimum, the VA must review the case to see if they can resolve it, issue a statement of the case, and then wait for the veteran or the claimant if it's not a veteran.
So what if the VA waited 25 years, that there was a delay of 25 years? Would that be unreasonable?
It would likely be unreasonable, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let's push, because you've got the weasel word in there, right?
I can give you one hypothetical, Your Honor.
No. You know what? In all seriousness, it doesn't work when you talk at the same time that I do. Right?
I
did it again. Right? Let me ask the question. I've asked you 25 years. You have the weasel word in there that says likely. Now I'm going to say 50 years. VA has waited 50 years. You have no other fact. There's no other fact in my hypothetical. 50 years. Is that unreasonable?
Likely, yes, Your Honor.
Is there any period of time in which you would be able to tell me, simply knowing the number of years, that it's not just likely, but it is unreasonable? 100 years.
No, Your Honor, because the duty to assist could require VA via this court's case law, if it was an increased rating claim, Your Honor, and the day before the veteran said, my disability has worsened, that requires VA to provide him a new and exam.
So it really truly is, think about this, right? You're representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs of the United States, okay? You just told me that you could not tell me that if VA waited 100 years to decide a claim, that might be reasonable. I really want you to be very careful if that's going to be your position.
It would be extremely unlikely that that would ever happen, that would be reasonable.
I did not ask you that. In my hypothetical, it has happened. It is 100 years. Can the Secretary of Veterans Affairs take the position in public now that a 100-year delay is unreasonable? I cannot believe that you are fighting on this question.
No, Your Honor, we stand by our answer.
Well, it's rare in oral argument that I can say that some of my opinions have changed, but they have changed dramatically. I was going to ask you about jurisdiction, but if you have a position on jurisdiction, that's fine. But I have moved now dramatically closer to my colleague, Judge Greenberg.
Which is saying something.
So do you have a position?
Let him bully you.
This is my last question for you. Does the Secretary have a position about whether this court has jurisdiction given the notice of appeal that's filed and pending before?
No, Your Honor, we don't have a position.
You have no position? Okay.
What about 4 years in the case of Mr. Dolphin? Is that unreasonable?
No,
per se?
No, Your Honor, we don't.
Well, what have you been doing to help him out over the 4 years that he's going to be better off? And when is he ever going to see the end of the case?
During the 4 years, Your Honor, he was granted several benefits that resolved, I think he had 17 issues in his notice of disagreement. He's currently receiving a total disability, and I believe special monthly compensation as well. So he has...
But what's left? Is it important?
It's earlier effective date, Your Honor.
Does that have a monetary value?
It does have a monetary value, Your Honor.
Is it a substantial monetary value? One that would rise to constitutional dimension, meaning a deprivation of an important economic benefit without due process?
I believe, Your Honor, that his is a few months of earlier effective date, so it would have a monetary value, Your Honor, yes.
I asked whether it was substantial, or is this a modest claim that we should defer to the Secretary?
I believe...
You know what it is?
I don't know the exact numbers, Your Honor, no. What the exact payment would be.
Should you? Should the VA know what's involved? Monetarily, in terms of setting an effective date, combined with, let's say, the age of the veteran, in order to move things along more expeditiously? Or is it irrelevant?
It's not, the amount of money is not irrelevant, Your Honor. I don't know the exact.
How about the age of the veteran? Congress thinks you ought to move things along for older veterans, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. VA does prioritize older veterans, but I believe that the year is 85 when VA prioritizes older veterans. VA also prioritizes homeless veterans and prisoners of war, and there are certain veterans that VA does give priority to at the regional office level. When they are at the board level, like Mr. Dolphin's claim is, they're, you can file to have your claim expedited if you have hardship. That's not happened in this appeal, Your Honor. So currently, Mr. Dolphin's appeal is proceeding under docket order.
Do you know when, based on when he filed his substantive appeal, that he can expect to have a board video conference?
No, Your Honor. The Kimberly Osborne declaration wasn't able to get the information about.
Do you know what month or year of substantive appeals they're processing right now or hearing appeals on right now?
I know that they were processing the late 2016 as of at the end of last year, docket numbers from late 2016.
But and when did he file his?
His VA Form 9 in 2018, January, I believe.
So it'll be a while.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then from when he gets his hearing, it could potentially be more than a year before he gets a decision.
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't lose his place in the docket.
Right, but it's just more time.
Yes, Your Honor. The hearing does delay the decision, Your Honor, because the board, the VLJs have to do the hearings themselves, so they're...
Well, if they have to decide them in docket order, it can't delay the decision, can it? Because don't they have to schedule the hearing such that they can then still process his decision with the same batch?
I believe the court addressed that issue in Ramsey, I believe, where the court said, I believe it was an en banc decision, that literal strict docket order is not required.
Right. Well, it's not 223, 224, whatever, but it's not like they can have him be a year out from everybody else.
I believe, Your Honor, that Ramsey did address the hearings about how if someone had requested a hearing, you wouldn't have to delay everyone else's appeal behind him in the queue, Your Honor.
Never mind. One of the things that your opposing counsel has asserted as a ministerial act is the certifying of an appeal, and I believe the Federal Circuit also considered that to be a ministerial act in Martin. Do you assert that that's a ministerial act?
No, Your Honor. I believe that issue is pending in Godsey, but the Secretary has argued that it's not a ministerial act.
Why is that? What is involved?
The certification of appeal, you have to, the person has to do the checklist to make sure everything is in order, which involves reviewing the file. So it involves some file review to ensure that the duty assist has been complied with and to just ensure all the jurisdictional prerequisites are also satisfied before it goes to the board.
So if a duty to assist issue were found, would whoever is doing that review have the authority to order another exam or something like that?
I believe they do that, yes, Your Honor, before they would send it to the board. If there's a duty to assist issue, they would attempt to remedy it if they
And by jurisdiction, do you mean that the claims that are being sent up are actually the ones that are on appeal to the board, or what do you mean by that?
Oh, that they had filed the appropriate documents too.
So as opposed, like an SOC has actually been issued already, things like that?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Sorry, that was confusing.
It's just somewhat of an opaque process to us.
So going to the second step in the track analysis, which the government believes weighs heavily in its favor, which is whether Congress has established a deadline. Congress has not. In fact, Congress is aware of the problem that there are delays at the Secretary's level, from getting board decisions, and has considered deadline from the certification to the board, from the Form 9 to the certification, in fact, what we were just discussing, Your Honor. And that deadline was a 1 year. They considered that 2016, and they never passed that bill, so the Congress rejected that deadline when they passed the Appeals Modernization Act without inserting any deadlines there. The Congress is trying to balance the process, which is a lot of the reasons that go to the first track factor, that it takes time to go from a notice of disagreement to the board decision with speed. So they're trying to balance both of that, and the Secretary is doing that as well. The third track factor is the health and human safety, health and human welfare. The petitioner's claims all involve that. That's true. Your Honors.
So in your brief, you asserted that that shouldn't weigh in the petitioner's favor because most of what VA does involves health and human safety. Are you changing your position here?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't weigh heavily in their favor, I guess I would put it, because of that reason. Most of VA's duties do involve health and human safety. The fourth track factor is also important. It would explain what I think you've referred to as the inaction, basically the time spent waiting in a queue, so to speak. As Ms. Classy declared for Mr. Dauphin's appeal, when he was at the DRO, once they finished the development in 2016, the DRO worked his appeal they worked the oldest appeal first, and so he was waiting because of the constrained resources that VA has. So that goes to the fourth track.
Has the Secretary set greater resources to address this problem?
Yes, Your Honor. November 2018, I believe, Secretary presented a report to Congress outlining plans to use resources to get the legacy appeals adjudicated as quickly as possible while also implementing the Appeals Modernization Act. So there's a balance of resources there, but the Secretary is trying to reduce the back legacy of appeals, which is the four.
Is that a shift away from their prior policy of emphasizing initial decisions by the AOJ and letting appeals have less resources?
I don't know if it's precisely a shift, Your Honor, because it's also implementing the Appeals Modernization Act, so it's a new prioritization that does emphasize reducing the legacy appeals backlog, but it's hard to describe it as a shift in priority because the priorities are completely new with the Appeals Modernization Act. And the fifth track factor, Your Honors, our view is that the petitioners haven't proven that they are totally reliant on the benefits that they're seeking. I note that three of them are seeking back benefits, and we can see that that's important benefits to them, but the Federal Circuit emphasized on whether the benefits would be their only source of income. They haven't pled that.
Only isn't the word, isn't it? It's rely heavily. Isn't that the concept in factor number five? That the veterans rely heavily on these benefits to support themselves as a family.
I believe the Federal Circuit said that it would weigh more heavily in their favor if they did not have another source of income. So they haven't pled that they don't have another source of income. So we believe that that does not weigh heavily in their favor. Although the Secretary concedes that benefits are important to all veterans, including retroactive benefits, which are what three of these petitions are about, Your Honors. And the sixth track factor is whether the court is not prohibited from granting a writ if there's, even in the absence of bad faith. There's no bad faith, so that factor doesn't really weigh heavily in either way. It doesn't prohibit the court from issuing a writ, but also it's not really a thumb on the scale for petitioners either in the absence of bad faith. It would really just go to the other five.
If the court were to believe that we need to reach the constitutional question, would you advocate that we apply the FDIC v. Mullen test?
That test is acceptable to the Secretary, Your Honor. As the Secretary noted in our brief, we believe that their reliance on statistics doesn't satisfy their burden of proving due process violation. And for the fact you were talking about earlier, Your Honor, of whether there's a risk of erroneous deprivation because of this decision was wrong, they've only relied on statistics as their basis for that.
Well, what else could they have shown? We're not going to be deciding their effective date appeal here. So what evidence would do you think that they would need to show to demonstrate that?
They could have made an argument that showing that their decisions were wrongly decided, Your Honors.
So just an assertion?
I mean, there would need to be a reason, I believe, Your Honor. They didn't provide any reason, so I don't have anything to respond to on that, Your Honor. But
okay. That's fair.
And the Secretary maintains that Ms. Ovi's, Mr. Hudson's, and Mr. Monk's petitions are moot. Even though the petitioners say board decision, they have seemed to be saying any kind of disposition by the board, including a remand. So Mr. Monk and Mr. Hudson got the relief that they were seeking. And Ms. Ovi, RO granted her claim to have her daughter listed as a dependent, so her claim was granted. And she has not, as far as, at least until Monday when I checked her file, had not filed a notice of disagreement to that decision.
So she hasn't filed a notice of disagreement. I thought your opposing counsel said that she had filed one in April.
She filed a notice of disagreement to the denial. There was a second denial. It was undated that came. I believe it was issued in March, but it didn't have a date on it. And she filed a notice of disagreement to that. That denial also addressed her daughter's being added to her as a dependent. But because the claim was granted, it would resolve.
So you're asserting that no NOD has been filed as to the effective date of the dependent kicker?
Not as of Monday, or at least it had not been uploaded into VBMS, Your Honor.
That's something I'm going to ask you guys to address.
If it was filed, it wasn't uploaded into VBMS by Monday.
Because I tend to agree with you, I don't think that there is an NOD with respect.
Yeah, I didn't think
there's no. As far as I can see, there's no effective NOD with respect to the effective date, but. If she were to file an NOD, it's not that her claim is moot, it's that it's not ripe, right? I mean, in other words, assume she filed the NOD yesterday. She has an NOD, but the delay would be 2 days, right? And so she may be able to make a claim not be moot, but that's because it's too early, right?
Yes, I believe the words that the Federal Circuit used was that the delay has been reset or something to that effect when they were discussing that issue in Martin.
So it seems like if we were keeping a scorecard, Ms. Obi is either potentially in the list of people who are moot or in her own category of people who aren't yet in a position to have experienced any delay.
Or both at the same time.
her past is moot and her future with respect to the effective date hasn't yet sprung into life, right?
I would phrase it exactly the way you put it. I think that's correct. The 2015 and 18 NODs were resolved and they're moot. Any future NOD is not ripe for delay review. The Secretary respectfully asserts that the court should not find that the exceptions to mootness apply in these cases. With regards to the trying to evade judicial review, the petitioners have put forward no evidence of that. Cardona case says that the court should look at heavily into whether there's evidence of bad faith for that exception. In fact, the Secretary put forth a declaration from Kim Osborne stating that Mr. Monk's and Mr. Hudson's were decided in docket order. In the petitioner's proposed reply brief that they filed on Friday, they make the same allegation about Ms. Obi, but they didn't plead that in their pleading, so the Secretary couldn't rebut an argument that VA had purposely mooted her claim when they didn't argue in their original brief that VA had. To my knowledge, there's no evidence that that happened.
But there's no question that I wouldn't phrase it as bad faith on the Secretary's part, but there's no question that the squeaky wheel gets the grease or something, if that's the right metaphor, right? I mean, all of us enter orders asking the Secretary to respond to petitions, And I now have taken it upon myself to be very careful to do that, because there are times in the past when I literally have just wanted your office to actually tell me some information. But no matter what, even when I wrote in a letter, you don't need to do anything but give me, in an order, you don't need to do anything but give me information, still magically the thing that the person is seeking a writ for automatically gets done, right? So there's no question that whether you call that bad faith, I wouldn't, because it's helping a veteran. There's just no question that the secretary does go and fix problems that are identified, even when the person gets out of order, right?
The secretary does fix problems if they're identified, Your Honor. I don't believe that the secretary would do something like decide a board decision out of order. If someone filed a writ for a board decision not being issued and there was a problem, for example, the file was lost and it was behind, and it was something that would probably be unreasonable because, say, the board is deciding August 2016 Form 9s, and this veteran filed his Form 9 in 2014, and there was a problem, and it should have been decided by then. The secretary would probably take action to fix that.
And I agree. In my experience, actions at the board have been less common than before the VBA. But my question actually goes to one point that your opposing counsel mentioned, which is, doesn't, though, that action, right, counsel perhaps in favor of the court issuing a precedential opinion with some perhaps bright lines in it? Because otherwise, the only people who benefit from the solicitude of the department's error-correcting mechanisms are the people who think to file a writ here. Maybe establishing bright line rules for certain even aspects of the process would be more fair to all veterans as a group than just the select few who decide to file a writ.
Well, the secretary would disagree, Your Honor, that a bright line rule is necessary, because mistakes are different from the process and the restrictions on the process by resource constraints. For example, the secretary does not believe that Mr. Dolphin's delay is unreasonable because of the process he went through. I know that the petitioners only focus on his effective date appeals, but that doesn't change the fact that his NOD had 17 different issues, and they went through the DRO process together. And that the DRO process was beneficial to him. He was granted substantial benefits because of that. And then now he is waiting in the queue at the board. And if the court were to grant his petition, the secretary would effectively have to move him to the front of the queue to decide his appeal. 60 days, I believe, is what they're pleading. So the bright line rule, while it may be regrettable that there are mistakes that are made, and VA does make mistakes sometimes that do get corrected because they were called to someone's attention by a writ, Your Honor, the secretary doesn't believe the mistakes are sufficient for the court to just announce a bright line rule based on the facts of these petitioners we have here.
If we established a bright line rule like the petitioners seek, Mr. Dolphin wouldn't jump to the front of the queue. Everybody would jump to the front of the queue. And I don't know how the VA would implement that, but the theory would be that they would be processing thousands and thousands of claims all at once to meet this 1 year deadline, as opposed to he's up here and the people that are behind him are still waiting. So while I appreciate your answer, I don't know that it's actually responsive to the reason why we shouldn't set a bright line rule that applies to all veterans, as opposed to saying his delay was unreasonable, then he jumps the queue. See the difference?
Yes, Your Honor. That if the court were to establish a bright line rule as short as the one that petitioners have asked for, it's unclear what steps, if any, that the secretary could even do to comply with it because of the duty to assist and the procedural requirements, SOCs, hearings. It's unclear if they would, if the secretary would just have to skip some of those steps and issue board decisions, or how that would even be a workable solution. Believe me, the secretary would adjudicate appeals that fast if he could. It's not that the secretary is trying to be slow in adjudicating legacy appeals, Your Honor.
Under the Appeals Modernization Act, I believe there are certain timelines that the secretary predicted for these new lanes, that they would be deciding higher authority review within so many days. They did not set a timeline predicted for a board decision, did they? Or they did if you didn't have a new evidence or a hearing was a year or something?
I believe, Your Honor, that they will resolve most of the legacy appeals by 20.
Well, this wasn't the legacy appeals, for the new, under the Appeals Modernization Act process. So if somebody chooses the lane to go to the board decision route, is there a timeline that the secretary has predicted that they would receive a board decision within, if they don't have a request for a hearing or new evidence?
I don't know on the Appeals Modernization Act.
I think it's 1 year. I think that the no evidence, no hearing lane was.
And that's after they get their initial denial from the AOJ. So the secretary thinks optimally it can do that part of the process within a year, but not the entire process.
I believe under the Appeals Modernization Act, Your Honor, when you file an NOD, you go straight to the board without any of this in-between process that we're discussing.
Okay.
I just have a slightly different question. What if we were to order, regardless of the outcome, the secretary to publish the court's decision and perhaps even the opinion on va.gov so the entire world of the veterans would see it rather than the parties to this case? Would you have a problem with that?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Is va.gov the way in which the secretary communicates with veterans, broadly speaking, on policies, changes, important cases, important regulations, and so forth, to those who have registered with the department?
The VA does communicate with veterans on va.gov.
Right. So to answer my question, you have a problem with our ordering the secretary to publish this decision on va.gov for all the world to see?
Your Honor, if you order us to do that, the secretary will comply with the order.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, the secretary rests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you need a bigger table, too. You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge Sholin. May it please the court, about $150,000. About $150,000 is the effective date difference for Mr. Dolphin. That is a life-changing amount for him and his wife. That is the 4 years denied to Mr. Dolphin for the benefits he's been seeking. That's what remains live.
And that, no matter how you slice it, is an amount significant enough to rise to a constitutional matter. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, denying through today that amount of money is a substantial economic benefit denied or taken away without due process of law.
Agreed. A significant property interest constitutionally deprived.
Ms. Nooner, I may be the only one up here who is concerned about this, But for me, this may be the most significant issue to get to where you want me to be, which is to grant the writ for Mr. Dolphin. Right? I am concerned about the court's jurisdiction. And there's nowhere to look. There's nothing equivalent to this. And so I would love your views on that question because of the filing of the notice of appeal.
Let me do my best to assist. Subject matter jurisdiction is the first threshold issue for you, all of you. I think we are in uncharted waters because we don't have Rule 23. We don't have Rule 23F, which the rulemaking body would have given in the first sentence the capacity to the circuit court to do the interlocutory review. But I think it's within your discretion, and I think because we're in uncharted waters, you have the capacity to look to the last sentence of Rule 23F, which states that an appeal does not stay proceedings in the district court.
So let me ask you a question. You've been practicing a long time, and I practiced a long time ago prior to the adoption of Rule 23F. And I, too, was at a big law firm, so we were usually on defendant sides, as Simpson Thatcher is. You're on the wild side now, right? But in the old days, of course, people would try to get up to the circuit courts, and they'd have to be very creative because these were interlocutory orders. And so in the context of when they tried to do this, my recollection is they usually tried to use the collateral order doctrine. Do you happen to know what happened jurisdictionally in the district courts when somebody was going up to the blank circuit on a collateral order? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because that's, the closest analogy as to what this is.
I think that in the collateral doctrine world, if it was certified by the district court and accepted by the circuit court, I think that it did divest the district court of jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that it had to be certified because that was the other route. The other route was like a 54B partial.
Yes, yes.
Right. But in the collateral order doctrine, I think you simply can file a notice of appeal because your position as a party is it is final because it comes within there. And in that's the situation that I'm wondering what happened. Would that divest the district court of jurisdiction?
So we're both working cooperatively off our memories. I think the answer is yes, but I'm not sure that could have been used in the class certification context. It would have been used alternatively in like an injunction type context because you would have had to been able to make the showing that it had finality to it. My recollection is people pre-23F were trying to use the interlocutory and the consequence really of the Federal Rules Committee allowing the 23F in limine review is to afford the provisional review but not stymie the district court from going along its track. And I would submit it works sometimes when we're up on 23F. We do make simultaneous applications for a stay of the proceedings because if the court's going to reverse and allow for certification or reverse, you know, the other way, then you want the discovery to proceed on a correct path. I think it's not just a matter of the VA's agreeing because you have to have your own statutory authority. I would submit that in this uncharted world, you do have the capacity to continue to adjudicate the individual merits the way Judge Hagley kind of did back at the beginning of Mr. Monk's proceeding when he said, I'm going to give a certified order on the no class action, no authority, but I'm going to continue to adjudicate Mr. Monk's individual petition. So I think
that. So basically, since this is uncharted, I'm testing out an idea here, testing out the idea that since this is uncharted and we don't know what the Federal Circuit's going to do, I mean, because it's going to have to consider its own jurisdiction, even if the government doesn't object to it, maybe we take our jurisdiction out for a spin, and if we're wrong, let the Federal Circuit tell us that, right?
I think you have that capacity.
Well, why wouldn't we have that capacity? My experience is actually a little bit older than my colleagues. I was admitted, I think, the same year as Rule 23 was adopted. That's a new rule, but we have centuries of aggregate action cases under equity, long before 1966. And we have a unique set of circumstances here. Aren't we deemed by Congress, at least one circuit, to be the exclusive forum for adjudicating veterans' claims? So why is it wrong for us to, or why should we be timid about asserting our Article 3 plus Article 1 capacity? Article 3, all the Supreme Court and tribunals or courts inferior to it have all law and equity powers. That's Article 3. We're created under Article 1. So why is this uncharted waters? Why can't we enjoin the Secretary from refusing to decide these cases?
On that, Judge Greenberg, I 100% agree that you're not uncharted, because under the All Writs Act, you do have the capacity to issue injunctions. I was on a sidebar about concurrent jurisdiction both here and in the Federal Circuit, but to your point, you absolutely have the capacity, the authority, and the discretion to issue a far-reaching injunction to the VA. In this case, and we urge you to, it's a precedential capacity in which you're sitting. It is an amazing opportunity post-Martin for the three of you to issue a bold but deserved writ to the VA, to the Secretary, saying that this delay is unconscionable. Let me, if I would, go to what this delay means. You are right, Judge Allen. We proffered 1 year as our class definition, 1 year from NOD to board decision. We still advocate for that as advocates for veterans. We recognize that you could retreat to Mr. Dolphin's circumstances, which is 4 years, 5 months, and counting. You had a disturbing colloquy with the Secretary's counsel. 50 years could not be stated to be unconstitutionally too long, nor could 25 years.
100 years.
It got out to 100 years. You have help. You have a foundation. Urs Behmer, back in 1990, said 10 years was unreasonable. And, you know, if you look at it, it also said both of the remand time periods were unreasonable, and one of those was 3 years. Now, you could say Urs Behmer absolutely gives you an outside time frame of 10 years being too long. Most veterans' appeals now are taking closer to 6 years. We submit 4 years for Mr. Dolphin is unconstitutionally and statutorily too long as a matter of law. Yes, Judge Sholin, he did ask for a DRO hearing, and he got one. Yes, he did have 10 medical exams. That's important. The development of the record is important. He then waited until January 2018 to get that DRO decision. You're right, it's 69 pages, and it does do a pretty extensive job of adjudicating his issues.
Dawn, please add 5 minutes.
But overall, did he have to wait for the time that it took for that SOC? He was done with all of his medical exams in July 2016. When he got his SOC in January 2018, files his Form 9 like that. It's been a year just to get the certification. Hartford sending it to DC. They say in February, Mr. Dolphin, we'll tell you when the file is received. He still hasn't heard. That's 6 weeks later. And we're going to wait, if history and statistics are our tutor, another year for it to be docketed. And after that, another year for the board to make its decisions. That $150,000 is not going to even be adjudicated for two more years. We would respectfully request an order now, because we're worried that if you don't do it now, we could magically get that decision or that BVA intervention that moots it. And we don't want to put you in that mooted world. Mr. Dolphin is the ticket to the merits that we're seeking, and we acknowledge that he is our strongest case. We think that VA does need direction. We think the track factors weigh, some more strongly than others, but all weigh in our favor. And we do think it is worthwhile, important, and necessary to get to that Fifth Amendment, to get to that due process clause, even though, Justice Brandeis said, be wary of treading into the Constitution if you don't need to.
Yeah, but Justice Brennan in Johnson against Robeson, didn't he say that the courts are always open to adjudicate constitutional issues, even if you can't bring the actual merits of the case?
100% agree. Right. And we think that it would resound from the mountaintops for this precedential panel to tell the VA, go with 4 years. 4 years in Mr. Dolphin's case is unconstitutionally too long and under track, statutorily unreasonable.
I'd like to follow up with a question that I said I'd be asking. Can you talk to me about Ms. Obey's NOD and her status of her appeal, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the confusion lies in the fact that there were two NODs. The second NOD, which is the one that you've been focused on, is from April 2018. I think the VA has made an error in analysis, and here's why. They say that the decision that Ms. Obey received in November 2018 adjudicated both NODs, the one back from 2014 and the one from 2018. That's wrong on the face of it. On the face of it, the decision that she received says we made a decision on your appealed claim for additional benefits for your dependents, which is Brittany, received on August 3rd, 2015. This November decision is adjudicating and resolving only the 2015 NOD.
So what did the second NOD say that the first NOD did not?
It asked explicitly for Brittany's benefits to go back to 2008.
But could she file an NOD as to effective date when she hadn't received the underlying benefit yet?
Well, that's the funny issue. She did get that very weird, undated decision, but it's March.
But that denied her benefits, though.
It did. And so she filed the NOD properly in April.
As to the denial of the underlying benefit, not as to the effective date, although she did argue effective or mention effective date in that.
That's right. She did argue, it's our reading of this, that her April 2018 NOD effectively and specifically asked for Brittany's benefits to be awarded and to be dated as of July 2008. And you see that right on the second page of her NOD form. So in our worldview, that's live. Ms. Ford accurately said it was not part of our original petition. Okay, we acknowledge that. We did put it into the court through two supplemental filings, but we don't want to force you into pathways that you don't want to be in. Mr. Dolphin is the better pathway to the merits. I would just note, though, that Ms. Obey's second NOD, by the VA's own evidence, has not yet been addressed. And you know, here's a.
So, but I mean, I'm not. I'm just not convinced that second NOD is actually effective as to the effective date issue. I throw that out there not as advice, but just if I were representing Ms. Obey, I would file another NOD to make sure.
I would too.
I would three.
But so. But really, and I mean this with great respect to Ms. Obey, that's sort of a side issue, right? Because even if that NOD is effective, it doesn't yet even come within your 1 year.
That's why we're not pushing it.
Great. All right.
I just wanted to correct the record, because if you were Ms. Obey, you could actually be sitting around waiting for that SOC on your April 2018 NOD, and no one's telling you that they're not going to do it, and it's not coming.
I agree.
But in light of these proceedings, yes, our entire team agrees we need to do a new NOD to protect our client.
Well, there has been some ruling from the bench then, so there.
We can't give legal advice.
That's right.
But the clarification is appreciated. You asked Judge Allen, do you have to adjudicate the 1 year? I would say you do not have to, because you're here on the individual petition. I think that our respective team and our clients would urge you to say that that 4 years presented in Mr. Dolphin's circumstances is unconstitutional and legally unreasonable. In terms of the order that could be issued, we would respectfully request an order on Mr. Dolphin sooner rather than later, just to preserve your jurisdiction and avoid any mootness issues, and the opinion can follow. The opinion to follow, we would implore you to go through the track analysis as ably laid out by Ms. Ford, and then proceed to the Fifth Amendment, and find that here 4 years is simply categorically too long. We believe that will be salutary in terms of this legacy body of remaining appeals, which the Secretary has said that they are prepared to adjudicate by the end of 2020. So this shouldn't be a resource constraint. They've certified that to Congress, that they have the resources. We believe your proclamation with the four-year rule brings Erspamer from 1990 up to the modern day, 2019, 4 years with our power and authority and our obligation to the veterans is simply too long.
I just have another sort of procedural type question. I noticed that there were a couple of original petitioners who elected not to go forward as part of the petition process, but in a footnote, you note that they wish to not have their petition dismissed because they wish to remain eligible to be class representatives. Let's say we decide this before the Federal Circuit decides that. In the decision, we would be dismissing their appeals based on their voluntary withdrawal, I assume. So how would that work for you?
I think, Judge Sholin, that this goes back to sort of the concurrent jurisdiction. I think that for their individual petitions, it would be appropriate, it would be okay to dismiss their individual petitions, but that would not necessarily preclude them from remaining live up at the Federal Circuit as individual petitioners who wish to serve as class representatives if the Federal Circuit deems that class certification was appropriate in this circumstance. If you, I may.
Yes. Don, please add 2 minutes.
Your Honor, with your indulgence.
Okay. I was waiting to see what was going to happen. Who's coming up there?
With your indulgence, it's wonderful to co-counsel with such able colleagues. On the concurrent jurisdiction point, perhaps this can be an additional element to assist the analysis. Under 38 U.S.C. 7292A, the Federal Circuit review is of CAVC decisions, not only orders. And review is, quote, in the manner prescribed for district court appeals. And we think that could be read to incorporate our sponsoring of the Rule 23F rubric, and in particular, the final sentence of Rule 23F that allows proceedings to remain existent in the district court.
Right, because Rule 23F does, by its terms, apply in the Federal Circuit. It just doesn't apply to this court directly. But that's helpful. Thank you.
And thank you to my colleague. Thank you all, Your Honors, on behalf of our entire team and all parties.
Thank you. The case will be submitted for a decision. The court is now adjourned. We will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.